10 seconds.
Especially with men who would view us as critics and literally would get in our faces and threaten to hit us, and marginalize us within hip hop. So the
Rosa,
industry, right? Like Russell and some others that I won't name. All I'm saying is that this runs the gamut. This runs the gamut from 5 years old to 65 years old.
We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank Rosa Clemente and Saru Jayaraman. Both attended the Golden Globe ceremony last night in Hollywood. Happy birthday, Clara Barra. I'm Amy Goodman.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the second annual David Bowie Memorial Bike Ride on his birthday, Monday, January 8th. Come ride your bike around Portland with Diablo as we celebrate the life and music of David Bowie with a mobile dance party and sing-along. Again, that's the second annual David Bowie Memorial Bike Ride at 7 p.m. at the Bowie Bike Lane at the corner of Southwest Broadway and Main on January 8th in downtown Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage on the community events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Stop the Pipeline rally on Thursday, January 11th at the Oregon State Capitol in Salem. The No LNG Exports Coalition hosts this day action at the Oregon State Capitol building to ask Governor Brown to deny the Pacific Connector fracked gas pipeline and Jordan Cove LNG export terminal. Carpools are available. Again, that's the Stop the Pipeline rally on Thursday, January 11th at the Oregon State Capitol, 900 Court Street, Northeast in Salem. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Trivia Fundraiser for Northeast Neighborhood Emergency Teams on Thursday, January 11th at 6 p.m. at the Lagunitas Community Room in Portland. This fundraiser includes disaster theme and pop culture trivia led by Katie Wolf, food, beer, cider, and information about your local neighborhood emergency teams. Again, that's the Trivia Fundraiser for Northeast Neighborhood Emergency Teams on Thursday, January 11th at 6 p.m. at the Lagunitas Community Room, 237 Northeast Broadway Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hope you might join us on New Year's Day of 2018 from 8 a.m. to noon for a special Michael Wells Memorial Dawn Concert. Michael Wells was a longtime KBOO volunteer, programmer, and worked as station manager and board member. Michael passed away last year. His many friends from KBOO and his family thought it would be a nice gesture to honor him by having a special Dawn Concert program to start the new year. In the early days of KBOO, Dawn Concert was a regularly scheduled morning program with a variety of program hosts. That's Dawn Concert honoring the late Michael Wells from 8 a.m. to noon on Monday, January 1st, 2018. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Scanner Foundation's 32nd annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast on Monday, January 15th at 8:30 a.m. at the Red Lion Hotel on the River in Portland. This year, Nelson Senior Vice President of U.S. Strategic Community Alliances and Consumer Engagement, Cheryl Grace, will be the keynote speaker. Grace has been with Nelson for 13 years, and for the past 7 years has overseen the production of a report on Black consumers, and will speak about the power of the Black dollar. Again, that's the Scanner Foundation's 32nd annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast on Monday, January 15th at 8:30 a.m. at the Red Lion Hotel on the River, 909 North Hayden Island Drive in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:10 and you're listening to KBOO, Portland 90.7 FM. Thought we'd open up with a little Coltrane before the news, which is coming up right now. And this program is made possible by KBOO members and support from the League of Women Voters of Portland, presenting an election forum for Oregon Ballot Measure 101 with yes and no speakers. How will you vote in the special election on January 23rd? This informational forum is Tuesday, January 9th from 7 to 8 p.m. at the Multnomah County Boardroom, located at 501 Southeast Hawthorne. More voter information can be found online at lwvpdx.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the ACLU has convinced the New Jersey Department of Corrections to lift a book ban.
The Bundy trial in Nevada will not go forward.
And the Trump administration is rescinding the temporary refugee status of over 200,000 El Salvadorians.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 8th, 2018. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Natalie Motti. The Public News Service is a member-supported organization that aims to shed light on the underserved areas in media coverage. Here is today's Daily Roundup.
Newscast for Monday, January the 8th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. In focus on our nationwide rundown, new revelations about Trump's schedule and so-called executive time. You've likely heard of Amazon, but did you know many of their workers rely on SNAP food assistance? And we look at whether including a citizenship question could be a recipe for a flawed 2020 census. Now, our top story, the scoop from Axios, is that President Trump is starting his official day much later than he did. Axios reports it's often around 11 a.m. They add he's in far fewer meetings, according to copies of his private schedule. Axios reports this is largely to meet Trump's demands for more executive time, which almost always means TV and Twitter time, alone in the residence. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders responded by saying the time in the morning is a mix of residence time and Oval Office time, but he always calls his staff, Hill members, cabinet members, and foreign leaders during this time. Retailer Amazon has grown substantially in states like Ohio in recent years, creating thousands of jobs and promising more to come. Mary Sherman reports a new analysis shows it's also become one of the largest companies whose workers need help getting by.
According to the findings from Policy Matters Ohio, about 1 in 10 Amazon employees or family members received SNAP or food assistance benefits in August 2017. Amazon has about 6,000 workers in Ohio. The Ohio Development Services Agency said Amazon has created thousands of new jobs and generated millions of dollars in new payroll consistent with Ohio's requirements for economic incentives. Amazon has not commented on the report.
Environmental groups in Colorado say they will double down on efforts to protect the state's water supplies, that after the Trump administration rolled back standards for hydraulic fracturing or fracking on public lands. More from Eric Gladys.
The U.S. Interior Department has reversed rules that would have required companies to disclose the chemicals they add to water pumped deep into shale formations to release oil and gas. Micah Parkin with the group 350 Colorado says these sorts of protections are important for public health.
If and when there are leaks, we would like to know what the chemicals that the companies are using contain, so you know how to at least try to remediate, how far to keep the public, and what sort of damage may have been inflicted.
A 2016 Stanford University report confirmed that fracking led to toxic chemicals seeping into drinking water in Wyoming. In reviewing the Obama-era standards, which also call for stronger well construction and safer wastewater disposal, the Interior Department decided the cost of compliance at nearly $10,000 per well was not justified. The American Petroleum Institute also felt the rules would slow up permits in states including Colorado, New Mexico, and Wyoming.
Fracking is the only industry allowed to inject toxic chemicals into underground sources of drinking water that after Congress exempted it from the Safe Drinking Water Act in 2005. And in the Sunshine State, in the first week of the 2018 legislative session, Florida House Speaker Richard Corcoran says his chamber will pass a bill to keep communities safe from what he sees as dangerous sanctuary cities. Tramell Gomes reports immigrants' advocates say what's dangerous is that Corcoran is stirring the pot.
Corcoran, who is expected to run for governor, says his chamber will pass House Bill 9, which would require state and local agencies to obey federal immigration enforcement and bar sanctuary policies, or anything that attempts to block the removal of unauthorized immigrants. Juan Escalante, with the group America's Voice, says Corcoran is playing politics at the expense of Florida taxpayers.
The willingness to use the Donald Trump playbook to try to exert his agenda and potentially, and I mean the agenda of the speaker, as a political catapult for a potential, you know, gubernatorial run or other aspirations that he may have in political office.
Escalante argues the bill would result in legal fees for taxpayers due to lawsuits and would also force the police to break with judicial precedent. Previous attempts to pass similar legislation have died in the Florida Senate.
And finally, a U.S. Justice Department request to include a question on citizenship for the 2020 census is raising concerns it could sabotage the results. Eric Tikhanov reports in a letter to the Census Bureau, the agency says the data collected from the question is needed to enforce the Voting Rights Act and to protect against racial discrimination in voting.
A U.S. Justice Department request to include a question on citizenship to the 2020 census is raising concerns it could sabotage results. In a letter to the U.S. Census Bureau, the agency says the data collected from the question is needed to enforce the Voting Rights Act and protect against racial discrimination in voting. The Justice Department request was first obtained by the news outlet ProPublica. Arturo Vargas, head of the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials, says fears this question will hurt response rates are grounded in real experiences. He says Census Bureau field representatives found people didn't answer questions accurately or completely in test surveys that included a citizenship question,
which has already signaled to the Census Bureau that there is fear in the American public about how the census information is going to be used. So if a census citizenship question were on the form that every single household receives in 2020, it could seriously depress response rates and result in a very flawed census.
In 2016, the U.S. Supreme Court asserted legislative districts should be drawn to include all people living within the district, regardless of their status as citizens. That's our news for now. I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
A 911 caller late Sunday evening claimed that an intruder was inside a home in Frederickson, a suburb southeast of Tacoma, Washington. During the call, dispatchers reportedly heard screaming and the sounds of a scuffle. Deputy Sheriff Daniel McCartney of the Pierce County Sheriff's Department was the first on the scene about 6 minutes after the call. The responding deputy encountered two burglary suspects, the department said, and at least one of them fired shots. When backup officers arrived, they found the bodies of Deputy McCartney and one of the suspects. McCartney, a 34-year-old U.S. Navy veteran, was the father of three sons. The second suspect is still on the loose Monday afternoon, authorities said. The ACLU is officially asking the New Jersey Department of Corrections to overturn a ban on the book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. The book, written by Michelle Alexander, is dedicated to inmates and chronicles the disturbing racial disparities within the penitentiary system. In the ACLU's letter to the state, the ACLU stated that the racial disparities within the New Jersey prison system were some of the worst in the country, and they said that the ban of the book was not only, quote, grossly ironic, misguided, and harmful, but also unconstitutional. In the state of New Jersey, African-American males are incarcerated at a rate of 12 times more than white prisoners. The conclusion of their letter stated, quote, that the very prisoners who experience the worst racial disparity and incarceration in the country should be prohibited from reading a book whose precise purpose is to examine and educate about that disparity adds insult to injury. As of press time, the New Jersey Department of Corrections has lifted its ban on the book.
Many social critics have complained that video games have been a contributing factor in the string of school shootings that have plagued the U.S. Now the U.S. government is trying to use a video game to reduce the effects of this type of tragedy. The U.S. Army and Department of Homeland Security are jointly developing a first-person simulation game to help teachers understand what to do if they find themselves in an active shooter situation. The new simulation is part of a $5.6 million program, which was developed to train first responders to deal with school shooters. The game will advise teachers on best practices in school shooter situations, from locking and barricading doors to lining people up against the walls. It will also allow game participants to roleplay as police officers trying to kill the shooter, or as the shooter trying to kill whomever they meet. According to an Army spokesman, quote, "We want to give teachers the chance to understand what options are available to them and what might work well for them," end quote.
Special Counsel Robert Mueller has raised the likelihood with President Trump's legal team that his office will seek an interview with the president. Mueller raised the issue of a Trump interview in a late December meeting with the president's lawyers. An unnamed source in the White House told the Washington Post that the special counsel's team could interview Trump very soon on limited and specific questions. According to the Post source, Trump would be comfortable with an interview and believes it would put to rest questions about whether his campaign coordinated with Russia in the 2016 election. According to White House lawyer Ty Cobb, all interviews of White House personnel by Mueller's office were on schedule to be completed by the end of December or early this year. Special prosecutors have interviewed sitting presidents in the past, including George W. Bush and Bill Clinton, though courts have urged investigators to seek such interviews only when they could not obtain information any other way.
Citing prosecutorial misconduct, Judge Gloria M. Navarro of Federal District Court dismissed the case against the Bundys for illegal cattle grazing in Nevada due to prosecutorial misconduct. In what many say could have been a slam-dunk case, the prosecuting attorneys failed to release pieces of evidence that could have helped the defense of the Bundys. Judge Navarro stated that, quote, "The government was well aware of theories of self-defense, provocation, and intimidation. And here the prosecution has minimized the extent of prosecutorial misconduct," end quote. The prosecuting attorneys released a statement to their defense as to what motivated them to withhold evidence. Quote, "As a result of threats to witness and the speed at which personal information can spread on social media, the government concluded it could not simply turn over its entire database," end quote. Upon release, Cliven Bundy stated that, quote, "This court has no jurisdiction and authority over this matter, and I have put up with the court in America as a political prisoner for 2 years," end quote. He then called the state and Clark County Sheriff aiders and abettors and terrorists for failing to protect his family's rights and liberties.
Climate Connections is a daily podcast focused on how climate change is affecting our daily lives and what we can do to curb it.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. It's an hour before the puck drops at a Blackhawks hockey game at the United Center in Chicago.
Oh, what's that?
Cars are jockeying for parking spots, and fans sporting red jerseys stream into the arena.
Oh.
On their way, they may pass a few premium parking spaces that double as charging stations for electric vehicles.
So if you're an electric car driver and you go to the United Center, you can use these stations entirely free of cost.
Scott Mercer is CEO of Volta, the company that owns the stations. In addition to the four at the United Center, Volta's deployed about 60 more around Chicago and networks in several other cities. Ads are displayed at each station, providing revenue that keeps the charging free for drivers and parking lot owners. Volta targets high-visibility locations to get people's eyes both on the ads and the charging stations themselves. Ultimately, the goal is to spark more interest in electric vehicles.
People who just see Volta charging stations are more likely to consider buying EV the next time they look for a new car.
More people driving electric vehicles means less carbon pollution and more demand for charging locations. It's a win for EV owners and the Earth. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Nicole Graff and Liz Crane about their new book, Grow Your Own: Understanding, Cultivating, and Enjoying Cannabis. At 6, it's Labor Radio. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of around 40 degrees, followed by even more rain tomorrow, but a balmy high of 50. East of the Cascades and Hood River, it's going to be rain with a high of 46. Today's date in history would be Win-Win Johannes Gutenberg, inventor of the printing press. It marks the first time a book was printed in the Lithuanian language in the year 1547, as well as being recognized as the International Day of Typing in Malaysia. The quote of the day is from T.E. Lawrence: "The printing press is the greatest weapon in the armory of the modern commander." And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
National Native News, I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonio Gonzalez. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers made public a permit application submitted to build the Pebble Mine in southwest Alaska. The application paints a clearer picture of the controversial copper and gold mine a Canadian company wants to build upstream from the fishing hub of Bristol Bay. Dacia Eaton reports.
The permit application is hundreds of pages long and includes maps of the open pit mine the company wants to build in the Bristol Bay region, about 200 miles southwest of Anchorage. It shows a 1.1 billion ton capacity tailing storage facility and calls for an ice-breaking ferry to haul minerals across a large lake, along with roads to access the mine and leading to a port to ship minerals out for processing. In addition, it shows a natural gas pipeline would have to be developed to power operations. The Pebble Limited Partnership, a subsidiary of Northern Dynasty Minerals, has reduced the mine's footprint to 11 square miles in their application. It shows the company plans to mine 1.2 billion tons of materials over 20 years. Under the Obama administration, the EPA proposed putting restrictions on the project, but after President Donald Trump took office, the agency started a process to reverse their proposal. The EPA reached a settlement with Pebble, and the company began forging ahead, bringing on a new investor in December. The project is on state land, surrounded by Alaska Native villages. Virtually all of the region's indigenous people participate in subsistence fishing, hunting, and gathering for food, and many drink water from the rivers. Communities close to the proposed mine lack jobs and lean toward development, while those representing villages closer to Bristol Bay, where there's a thriving commercial fishing industry, are mostly against it. And they're quick to point out that the application shows over 3,000 acres of wetlands and waters must be filled in to build the mine site. In a written statement, Pebble Partnership CEO said that he believes as Alaskans become more familiar with the proposed project, there will be an increasing degree of support for it. The United Tribes of Bristol Bay organization was quick to condemn the permit. United Tribes are fighting the project, saying, among other things, it will harm the salmon fishery based downstream. The Army Corps plans to hold a series of public meetings, and officials say the permitting process could take years. In Anchorage, I'm Dacia Eaton.
President Donald Trump's nomination for the Indian Health Service remains under a cloud after questions about his stated experience. A Wall Street Journal report Friday questioned Robert Weaver's claims that he worked in a supervisory role at St. John's Regional Medical Center in Joplin, Missouri, from 1997 to 2006. He made the claims during a Senate Indian Affairs Committee hearing. The paper contacted officials with the hospital at the time who could not recall his name or his position with the institution. One former executive said he remembered someone by that name working in a subordinate position in the emergency room. Weaver is a member of the Quapaw tribe of Oklahoma. He told the Journal, "There is a lot more to the story than what you are being told." U.S. Senator Tom Udall, the vice chair of the Senate committee, told CNBC that the contradictions between Weaver's comments and the revelations in the Wall Street Journal raise a number of serious concerns. The California State Department of Justice concludes a San Diego State University American Indian Studies lecturer harassed and discriminated against a student because she is white. The Chronicle of Higher Education reports the department investigated after complaints by a student against Oscar Monge. A confidential report said Monge's messages to the student constituted animus toward white people. Monge has been a longtime critic of the university's mascot, an Aztec warrior. Before taking his class, the student had also worked to have the university retire the mascot. Monge says he is appealing the Justice Department's ruling. With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
Epiphany, also known as Little Christmas or Three Kings Day, is a Christian feast day that celebrates the revelation of God incarnate as Jesus Christ. In some traditions, Epiphany signals a whole season called Epiphanytide. The traditional day that begins Epiphanytide is January 6th, and in Portugal, in the village of Vale de Salgueiro, they have a unique tradition that creates an uproar with outsiders who come to visit. During Portuguese Three Kings Day, kids as young as five are allowed to smoke cigarettes. Yes, real cigarettes. Local residents say the practice has been passed down for several centuries as part of the celebration of life that is also tied to the winter solstice. But no one really knows what the smoking symbolizes. The two-day celebrations start Friday and end Saturday with a mass that, apart from smoking, includes dancing and gathering around bonfires, piper music, and an elected king who distributes wine and snacks. In Portugal, the legal age to buy cigarettes is 18, but nothing prevents parents from giving kids the ceremonial smokes, and Portuguese authorities don't intervene to stop the tradition. Portugal, like many countries, have taken noticeable steps to reduce smoking, including a partial ban on smoking indoors, Epiphany notwithstanding.
An Iranian oil tanker crashed with a bulk freighter and turned into a fiery blaze off China's coast, leaving the tanker's entire crew of 32 missing and causing it to spill oil into the sea. Chinese authorities dispatched police vessels and three cleaning crew ships to the area after the collision, which happened late last Saturday. The South Korean Coast Guard also sent a ship and a plane to help search for the missing crew members, which include 30 Iranians and two Bangladeshis. According to China's Ministry of Transport, the tanker Sanchi was sailing from Iran to South Korea when it collided with the freighter CF Crystal in the East China Sea, 160 miles off the coast of Shanghai. The 21-member crew of the Crystal, which was carrying grain from the U.S., were rescued. It's not clear what caused the collision, whether the tanker is still spilling oil, or the cause of the oil slick. An official in Iran's oil ministry who spoke to the AP on condition of anonymity said 30 of the tanker's 32 crew members were Iranians. He said, "We have no information on their fate. We cannot say all of them had died because rescue teams are there and providing services."
The Trump administration announced today that it is reversing its protected status for El Salvador within an 18-month delay. This is the latest in a line of legal immigration programs that have been discontinued over the past year. About 262,000 Salvadorians that have temporary protected status in the U.S. will have until September 9, 2019 to either change their immigration status, leave the U.S., or face potential deportation. 10 other countries have a protected status designation with the U.S. They are South Sudan, Sudan, Somalia, Nicaragua, Honduras, El Salvador, Syria, Nepal, Haiti, and Yemen. Before Thanksgiving, the Trump administration announced that the status for close to 59,000 Haitians would end on July 22nd of 2019. The status for Sudan ends in November of this year, and Nicaragua, with its 2,500 beneficiaries, is rolled back next January. Although many of the original disasters that spawned the temporary protection status of these immigrants in the first place have been deemed non-threatening, other circumstances within those countries have become just as threatening, if not more.
Puerto Rico has been facing one of the most severe crises since it was colonized by the U.S. in 1898. The island has been in a serious economic recession for over a decade, which has compelled 500,000 people to emigrate. KBOO's Zelis Marchant spoke to journalist and educator Hector Reyes in this next excerpt you'll hear about the history of Puerto Rico and how the Estado Libre Asociado, or ELA, hid the fact that as the U.S. went to the U.N. to change Puerto Rico's colonial status before 1950, it imposed laws requiring the U.S. to remain in governmental and financial control.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to kind of help people understand better what is really happening with Puerto Rico, because I do think there is a lot of goodwill in many places. You go, you know, in any city, any town, and, you know, people will kindly show concern for all the devastation. And however, most people, even many people on the left, really don't understand the dynamics of how, you know, the people of Puerto Rico have come to suffer for so many decades under what is supposedly to be a benign relationship with the U.S., but it has never been.
I was hoping you could explain what the Estado Libre Asociado is, which seems like where a lot of the erosion of rights began.
Well, the Estado Libre Asociado came into existence in 1952, out of some sort of a constitutional convention and previous vote on a constitution and so on and so forth. But it's really the result of a law approved by Congress, and the terminology conveys more than what it really is. You know, if you were going to judge very strictly by what the words mean, Estado, state, libre, free, and asociado, associated, you would think that there is a more equal relationship between the U.S. and Puerto Rico. But when you go, if you were able to do some research into years before that the Estado Libre Asociado came to be, you wouldn't have seen that there was plenty of discussion in the U.N. about the colonial status of Puerto Rico. And so, but once the U.S. was able to get this law approved, and then Puerto Rico to become this new shiny object that they could display and say, hey, they are no longer our colony. So you have to take them out of every year. The UN goes through this process in which they review all parts in the world that may be colonial. So the U.S. demanded that Puerto Rico be taken out of that list, out of that review. And if you fast forward to 2016, essentially all three branches of the federal government said that Puerto Rico is really just a colony of the U.S. They didn't use that term, but they all affirmed that anything that happens in Puerto Rico, the ultimate power lies in Congress. And that was the case of the Supreme Court. And there were two cases in the U.S. Supreme Court, and they both ruled essentially saying that Congress was the ultimate authority, and that what they had decided is shown a light in what was the specifics of those cases. Then, because Puerto Rico had been has been since 2006 an economic recession, and the government accumulated a debt by that time of $73 billion, and the government was getting to the point in which it would have to just declare bankruptcy if it was allowed, but because of the colonial relationship and the laws, the government wasn't allowed, but it was trying to. Eventually the Congress approved a law which essentially provided for the appointment of a oversight board like that in that was approved for example for Detroit, and but that this one would be for the whole of Puerto Rico. And that law was called the PROMESA, the acronym reads PROMESA, which in Spanish means promise. And it's very cool because it's a promise of what, well, it was all meant to, as a promise to pay all the Wall Street banksters all the money that was owed to them. And so that was approved by Congress, signed by former President Obama, and then Congress and Obama came together to appoint the 6 or 7 members of that board, which in Spanish board means junta, and so in Puerto Rico we call it la junta, and with a kind of in part to kind of give the flavor of the dictatorial juntas that plague Latin America during the 20th century, and that were completely supported by the U.S. government then, like the one in Argentina in the 70s and 80s and so on and so forth. Excuse me. So there you have the presidential branch, the congressional branch, and the judicial branch all saying in 2016, yeah, when we told the world back in 1952 that the Puerto Rico was no longer a colony, we were lying. There we go. And so they imposed this junta, and the junta essentially has the power to decide everything that has to do with budgets and finances and even laws, and with the purpose of essentially reconstructing the Puerto Rican budgetary process and the laws so that all the monies that were owed to all these hedge funds, etc., the vulture funds, would be repaid. And so they began that process in late 2016, and then we're going through imposing very severe budget cuts to the extent that with the plan they had, the University of Puerto Rico, which is a very, very good system, to the extent that I'm from the west part of the island, and from the town of Mayagüez, where the engineering school is, and every year the most prestigious companies in the U.S. or NASA would go to interview engineers from there. NASA has plenty of Puerto Rican engineers in its staff for decades by now. And so that system, it's going to lose about 3/4 of its budget, essentially meaning that up from 11 campuses, there will be barely any funding for 3 of them, the most prominent ones, which includes the campus that has the engineering school, the main campus in San Juan in the sector of Rio Piedras, and then the medical school. All the other campuses won't have any funding, essentially, according to how the plans were going. That was before the hurricane, so who knows what will happen now. So when you see now, there is not even the facade of having a Commonwealth, the Estado Libre Asociado, anymore. Everything is decided by a board of 6 people appointed jointly between the President of the U.S.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tom Flynn, Grace Ann Smith, Zelos Ellis Marchant, and Ken Jones. The producer is Grace Ann Smith. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Ellis Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Natalie Motti.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show covers politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener comments. At 9 on Alternative Radio, Rami Barhoush speaks on Jordan, Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, D-May Roberts welcomes artists from Milagro Theater's newest work entitled Bye, presented as part of the 2018 Fertile Grounds Festival. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Grace Cook Anderson of the Portland Art Museum talks about Don Cerny's sculpture show in the Apex series. KBOO keeps you informed and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. Good night, Natalie. Good night, Danielle.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Danielle.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Despite the latest efforts by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who, by the way, is facing his own considerable legal problems, marijuana is available by law in about 60% of the U.S. Recreational cannabis is legal in 8 states, with California the latest addition as of January 1st, and medical marijuana is legal in 29 states. In many of these states, it's not only legal to purchase and consume cannabis, but to grow your own, which just happens to be the title of a new book from Portland's Tin House Books, Grow Your Own: Understanding, Cultivating, and Enjoying Cannabis. As the title suggests, the book describes how to grow your own plants at home, but it also serves as a primer for newbies and advanced stoners alike on how to select a strain and the different ways to consume the drug. To find out more, we're fortunate to have two of the authors, Nicole Graff and Liz Crane, here with us in the KBOO studios. Nicole and Liz, thanks for coming into KBOO today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Nicole, let's start with you. You and Liz are co-authors of the book. I should mention your other authors, Micah Sherman and David Stein, and also the great work done by your editor, Tony Perez. Can you tell us a little bit about your background, Nicole, in growing cannabis and how the book came together?
Well, my background in growing cannabis started 4 years ago with the legalization in Washington State. Before that, I was working in fashion design in New York City and looking for a change. And
what a change, yes.
A big change. I was thinking just a different fashion company to design for, but this kind of fell in our laps, Micah and myself, and it was just something so exciting and unique that we couldn't say no. It really felt like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to be on the ground floor of such an exciting new industry, so we dropped everything and moved across the country and started working with David Stein, who is an old friend of Micah's father, who has been growing cannabis since he was in high school, and he's in his mid-60s now.
So, and that's Raven Grass?
That is Raven.
Company, and they're based in Washington.
We're based in Olympia, Washington. We grow all organic cannabis and produce a few ancillary products as well. So, yeah.
And Liz, I know your work, you're a fiction writer in addition to writing about Northwest food and restaurants and drink beverages. Can you tell us about your role as a Grow Your Own author and also some of the objectives you and Nicole and your co-authors had for the book?
Yeah, so when our editor, Tony Perez at Tin House, decided that he wanted to do a cannabis book and he wanted it to be open and accessible and maybe more female voiced. He wasn't sure. And he started, you know, looking for the right group of people to do that. And that led him to Raven Grass. They signed on. He convinced them that this was a good thing to do. And then his next step was, okay, well, who can I get to co-author this? And Tony had written about food for a bit in Portland, as I do. So he knew me through that world. And a cookbook that I did, Toro Bravo, he liked the way that I captured that chef's voice. So he asked me, and I said, oh, I would love to do that. I might have grown some own of my, you know, in the past, maybe. And so it was a topic that really interested me.
And the book starts with a section called
A Brief History of Cannabis Culture. Fortunately, it's brief because it stretches all the way back to 1450 BC. One of the things I didn't know, of course, there's many things I don't know, is that Columbus brought cannabis seeds to North America, and hemp actually was an early cash crop in the colonies and before we became a nation. How did such an important plant from both a health and economic perspective come to be demonized and banned?
Well, there's a few kind of competing things that I think got in the way of cannabis being really successful here. I think one of those was the tobacco industry. One of those was the cotton industry, which was in direct competition. And then just the general, you know, big pharma movement as that kind of took over. More natural medicines really got demonized, and cannabis got swept in with, you know, a lot of those and classified as a type A drug.
Yeah, you mentioned in that brief history, especially in the 20s and 30s, where it was demonized because it was used by a lot of African-American musicians. It was almost a form of racism, I think, to ban the drug at that
Very
point.
Very much so, and that's actually why we try and stay away from using the term marijuana in the book. That actually was a term that was brought about by the federal government to try and demonize cannabis because it was slang that was used by Mexican immigrants when they came over. So they used it kind of in conjunction with a lot of anti-Mexican rhetoric to try and scare people into staying away from it, which obviously didn't work so well.
Now, I mentioned Jeff Sessions in the intro, and Nicole, before we got on the air, you talked a little bit about him. But despite his efforts, it's still legal to cultivate your own cannabis plants in Oregon. What are the laws here for growing your own? I know Washington, you can't grow your own, but in Oregon, you can?
Correct. And I'm actually a Washington resident, so I can't speak to that as clearly
Liz,
as Liz probably
yeah,
can.
So basically, you can grow up to 4 plants at home. This is going to be a little bit loose. I'll hit some of the topics. You need to be within a certain distance of a public school, of an elementary school.
Oh, even if your house is across the street, you can't grow it in your backyard.
There's a certain distance, and I checked that before I grew at home, and I don't remember what it is, because I am quite close to, I live in North Portland, I'm quite close to Beach Street, Beach School.
Uh-huh.
And then...
And you were okay?
I was okay, okay. Yeah. And then also you want, if you're growing outdoors, you want to have your plants not be viewable from public street and sidewalk space. So that was fine for me because I just this summer and last summer grew in my backyard, which has a pretty tall fence.
And one thing I was confused about, there's a limit to how much you can grow. It's not per person in a house, it's per household?
Yeah, it's a... there's a weight limit, and I'm sorry, but I don't know what
that is. Oh, I thought it was
four
plants. I didn't
realize. Oh, yeah, that uh-huh. But also what you can harvest at home and have in your home from cultivating in Oregon. There is a weight law on the harvest, but I don't remember what that is.
But yeah. We can safely say that it is legal to grow it in Oregon,
yeah.
Given a few guidelines like distance from schoolyards and things like that. Now, Nicole, we mentioned your role in Ravengrass, so you grow cannabis professionally. How did you apply the lessons you learned as a commercial grower to the advice in the book? And you give the advice, it's mostly growing indoors in the book.
We do primarily focus on indoors, but we give a lot of disclaimers saying, you know, kind of our advice for the best way to tackle this book, if you don't want to invest a lot, is read the book over the winter, get familiar with the general concepts, cannabis in general, and then start outdoors, especially if you're in the Pacific Northwest. It's such a perfect climate, spring, summer, early fall here, that, you know, while a lot of this is geared towards indoor, it's very easily translatable. And it's funny because our commercial grow knowledge actually was taken from a lot of David's home growing knowledge. So we had to take what he had done, scale it up to go commercial, and then kind of scale it back down to do this book. And this book is ideally how we'd do things on a commercial scale if we could anyways. It's kind of our dream way of growing cannabis, which is organically in the earth, hands-on product at all times as much as you can. A lot of love and attention given to your plants.
Now, you go into the main components of cannabis. Now, two I knew, THC and CBD. Can you tell us a little about that? And then the third one I'll ask you about is one I don't know much about, but it's mentioned in the book.
Well, THC is the one that people are typically very familiar with when it comes to cannabis, and that is the primary psychoactive component of cannabis. The other one, CBD, has gotten a lot of traction lately, a lot of trendy articles written about it. It's very big in the medical world. CBD binds to the same receptors in your brain as THC. It's not psychoactive at all. It's very relaxing, has a lot of anti-inflammatory properties, antispasmodic, and anti-anxiety. So finding that perfect ratio between CBD and THC, which definitely talk to your local bud tender about, and they can help you depending on what your issues are, is crucial for a good experience.
Now, I've heard that CBD is actually legal, I think, in all 50 states, but it's not as effective unless there's a little THC involved in there. There must be some kind of chemical marriage between the two.
Yeah, what you're using it for. If it's for pain management, definitely you do need a little bit of THC in there to find that sweet spot of what works best for your body. The CBD that's legal nationwide is hemp-derived CBD, mm-hmm. and you're not allowed to have any trace components of anything else in it. So on its own, it's very effective for treating very specific things, but probably not for most of us interested in trying it.
And that third component I mentioned that I think I just learned about 6 months or so ago, and I've been a long time user when it was illegal too. This is terpenes, and you write in the book that over 200 terpenes have been identified in cannabis, and you pick out about 20 or so and describe mm-hmm. those in the book. How did you compile that list, and can you tell us a little bit about the terpenes' role in enjoying cannabis therapeutically and recreationally?
Along with terpenes, there are also a slew of tertiary and secondary cannabinoids, CBD or CBG, CBN, THCV. Terpenes are what make up a lot of the flavor and scent profiles of cannabis. We chose the 20 that we focus on in the book based on information we get from our testing labs in Washington State. Their profiles for what they test for are constantly changing as their knowledge expands. One of the benefits of this being legal all of a sudden is the research is just growing by leaps and bounds. So we're learning, you know, every few months, new terpenes that are actually really important in how your body interacts with cannabis. So working with them closely to make sure we had the most up-to-date version of the list in here. But they very much do affect your experience. Natural medicines share a lot of terpenes with cannabis. Linalool is a terpene that's found in both lavender and in a lot of cannabis strains, and it has the same benefits as you would think, you know, aromatherapy with lavender would have, very calming, very relaxing. Limonene is something that's found in citrus, and when you think citrus, you think bright, energetic, euphoric. Mm-hmm. It has the same effects when you're using a cannabis strain that has limonene in it. So again, paying attention to the terpene strains or terpene profiles of strains your body reacts well to can really help you tailor your experience in the future.
Now, I have a lot more questions, but we're kind of running out of time. So, Liz, I wanted to ask the last question to you. Your experience as a food writer, you go into the book, there's several different ways to consume it. We know some of them, smoking, tincture. But I'm particularly interested for you with edibles, how to cook with cannabis. And you give several recipes in there.
That was a really fun chapter. So Spot Edibles in Seattle developed all of the recipes for our cooking with cannabis chapter. And then I got to test them and my friends got to try them. And that was really enjoyable. But yeah, I made coconut oil and coconut oil infused with cannabis and butter. And then I made all of the recipes in the book, but also tried some on my own, like lemon bars and some really yummy muffins. And I think the thing that people are scared of with edibles, we kind of give you some good tips and pointers on how to just basically make your coconut oil or your butter infused with cannabis, try a quarter teaspoon, wait a couple hours. How does that feel? Is it a little bit too much? Not enough? And then use that to portion for your 10 brownies or your 10 pieces of So, yeah, I think dosing is always a kind of scary thing for people. Yeah.
Again, I'm sorry we have to wrap up soon, but I want to at least mention you'll be reading at Powell's Books, City of Books, this Wednesday, January 10th at 7:30. So cable listeners can have a chance to come down and meet you and hear about the book and buy a copy if they're interested.
And bring questions. We'll have a lot of time for Q&A, so everyone can get their questions answered.
Oh, great. Well, Nicole and Liz, again, thanks very much for coming into KBOO.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Nicole Graff and Liz Crane, co-authors along with Micah Sherman and David Stein of the new book from Tin House Press, Grow Your Own, Understanding, Cultivating, and Enjoying Cannabis. Nicole and Liz will be reading from the book 7:30 p.m. this Wednesday, January 10th at Powell's. That's 1005 West Burnside. For more information, you can check out the Tin House website, tinhousealloneword.com. I'm Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Stop the Pipeline rally on Thursday, January 11th at the Oregon State Capitol in Salem. The No LNG Exports Coalition hosts this day action at the Oregon State Capitol building to ask Governor Brown to deny the Pacific Connector Fracked Gas Pipeline and Jordan Cove LNG Export Terminal. Carpools are available. Again, that's the Stop the Pipeline rally on Thursday, January 11th.